It's so lovely to be here with you tonight. And, I always feel like it's such a gift when David asks, oh, would you like to come and share the Dharma, to come and visit with you on Tuesday night. And I always feel like I'm among friends, to come and sit and really practice together, and I felt the container. And tonight, I would love to share some reflections with you on how practicing with contemplating death, this vulnerability that, let's see, is that a little better? Okay. Practicing with death, this vulnerability that connects all of us, is a pathway to opening us to life. And, my talks often come out of what's alive in my practice at the moment. And so this spring, I was really finding myself feeling kind of heavy, deadened, disconnected from life. Sort of just from the weight of what we can pick up in this very complex and rather troubled world at times. There's a lot going on out there. And so I had fortunately scheduled many months ago two retreats for myself in May. And the first retreat was on contemplating death. So I feel like I went to a retreat on death, and it helped bring me back to life. And so I want to come and share with you some of the nourishment that I really felt from that week of practice. And you might just pause for a moment before I begin sharing to just reflect on, what's my attitude and relationship with death? You might check in, do you even have a relationship with death? Maybe it's flavored by a quality of friendliness, curiosity, aversion, avoidance, denial. And no need to judge whatever your relationship is or isn't, but it can just sort of help to check in every once in a while. Is death on your radar in any kind of conscious way? And I know for me, my experience of going on the retreat about death contemplation was sort of like meeting an old friend that I had kind of lost contact with. Death contemplation has been a practice I've really appreciated for many years, but it wasn't really in the foreground quite as much in my practice. And so going on this retreat was this opportunity to come home to these four contemplations that are, that are often known as the heavenly messengers. So these are what the Buddha encountered when he left the palace before he became the Buddha. And he left this very protected life, and he went out into the streets and he saw a very old person and he saw a sick person and he encountered a corpse and a monk. And he encountered and saw and touched these vulnerabilities that connect all of us. We're all born, and we're all going to die at some point. And so these messengers are called the heavenly messengers because they really help wake us up to life. It's not about this grim, depressing, heavy energy. It actually, paradoxically, often brings this real lightness into our being. It helps us open our hearts and really orient the compass of our mind and our heart to what's meaningful, to what's important. And so I wanted to share tonight some about this experience and then offer some very simple, concrete practices you could play with here in daily life, and also explore some of the benefits, because most of us don't like jump up and down and say, oh yeah, me, I want to hang out with death for the evening. You know, maybe if I had put death in the title, even fewer people would have, like, had come tonight. You would have been like, I don't know. That doesn't sound so appealing. So, but it's just really, it's such a delightful practice. And one of the things I love about it is that the heavenly messengers are natural. You know, it's not a mistake. It is just the lawful unfolding of what it means to be a being that's alive. And when we slow down and we open our eyes, death is actually everywhere. And in many ways, it's quite beautiful and miraculous. In part because it points us back towards life. But there's something about the honesty, the truthfulness of witnessing death. And part of the benefit of being on retreat is things get really simple. So you start to notice the things that normally you just fly by in a busy day. So on this retreat that was inviting contemplation of death, it really did start to show up everywhere. I would go for a walk on the land and, you know, here's a robin catching a worm, or the turkeys eating the insects in the grass. Or here's a lizard that is sort of dismembered on the trail and its entrails are splayed, or the dead mouse that I spent 3 days sort of each walk would notice more of it had disappeared as the ants were feasting on it. Or even the flowers, you know, the gardens were beautiful, and you know, I would watch an iris come into full bloom and then start to wither and dry up and fade away. So it was just this natural cycle. In these small ways, in short increments of time, and then there's sort of deaths in longer increments of time. There are beloved trees on this property that I've watched fully alive, and then a branch sort of comes down and it's half there, and then over the years, you know, more of it. And there was a tree this time that, you know, I've watched for many years and it had finally fallen. So death is everywhere. And, you know, often we don't turn toward that. And it's amazing to me, you know, even coming out of this retreat that was an invitation to focus on death and the vulnerability of living in a body. I came home, and within a week, I started to develop this infection in one of my eyes. And it was sort of mild, and then all of a sudden, like overnight, it completely sort of deteriorated, and I ended up in urgent care. Then I had a reaction to the medicine they put me on. I ended up back in urgent care. And it was amazing to watch what my mind did with that experience. How fast I went to, this should not be happening. You know, how can I get rid of this? How fast can this heal? You know, and I was so at war with the vulnerability of this body. You know, I was like, this is a mistake. And I was like, oh my gosh, you just spent like 15 hours a day contemplating how it's not a mistake to age, to be sick, to die, and how fast that survival instinct, that resistance arises in us. You know, and what was lovely coming out of that retreat is I was much more aware and I could watch the show. You know, I was like, oh, look at what my mind is doing with this. This is part of our relationship with death. It's not necessarily an easy friendship that we have with aging and illness and dying. It takes some work, like many long-term friendships. We have to really cultivate a connection. And, you know, I was drawn too on this retreat to reflecting about vulnerability in general. You know, there's this way that we resist touching into our vulnerability. And I was drawn to the banana slugs. So I was on retreat in California, and they have these magnificent banana slugs. They actually make guest appearances in my Dharma talks frequently because I'm so in love with them. You know, they're huge and they're amazing. And I was walking along and here's this slug in the middle of the trail. And like in my mind, the translation of that is, oh my God, what are you doing here? You're in the middle of danger. You know, there's such vulnerability. And I was actually really touched just sort of hanging out and watching. You know, because no armor, no protection, no place to hide. This slug is going nowhere fast. You know, if danger shows up, it's just doing its slug thing. And, you know, I don't think there's a speed button on these guys. You know, and I really, this one afternoon as I was sitting and watching, you know, I thought, wow, what would it be like to live a life that unarmored? You know, just out in the middle of it all. And I was reflecting on the ways that I'm not very much like that slug. You know, all those ways that I think so many humans, we protect, we hold back, we sort of stay to the edges where it's a little safer. You know, we even run. I know I run sometimes when there's vulnerability right there in front of me. And yet, oh, here's this possibility. And I also became aware of all the ways really and I think most of us are very much like the slug most of the time. You know, we have this illusion of protection, and yet, really, we're out in the middle of it all the time, even if we don't admit it. You know, I was leaving the retreat, and I got into the shuttle to go to the airport, and really, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm putting my trust in this vehicle and this driver, and we're going to hurtle at 70 miles an hour into who knows what from going the pace of a slug, and hopefully we'll get there in one piece, you know? Or we wake up and here's this infection and where did that come from? You know, so there's this way that we actually are unarmored if we can see it. And what does that really mean? One of the other teachers on the land that I really love, I already mentioned, just sort of watching trees go through their life cycle. There's a particular tree I was drawn to on this retreat, also for its teaching about vulnerability. They have these madrone trees, and I don't know if any of you know them, but they're these beautiful trees, very elegant, sort of expansive branches, but what's most distinctive about them is they have this beautiful red bark that peels off the tree in these lovely curls to reveal the softest, smoothest sort of underbelly of bark. And as I was walking, you know, I just had this sense that the trees were peeling themselves bare to actually be touched by life. And there's this one tree on the trail that years ago, somebody carved their name and a question into. Those of you who have been to Spirit Rock maybe have walked by this tree. And it was really heartbreaking years ago to see this, like at the retreat center. And what was really noticeable, I hadn't been there for a while, was how much it had healed. You know, so there's this sense of like, oh, we can bear ourselves. And when we bear ourselves to the world, things can happen to us. You know, this tree was a real example. And there was a scar. You can't really read the question anymore. I can't remember what the question was, but you can see sort of, it's like Braille, these bumps on the tree. And there's this, there was just this sense of like, oh, this is what can happen. We can open ourselves to life, and sometimes it touches us in ways that are beautiful and gentle, and sometimes we get carved on. You know? Most of us probably have those experiences that have been written on our hearts or on our nervous systems that we carry with us to this day. You know? So there's this way that vulnerability is the in many ways the heart of our experience of being human. It's what connects us, even though it's often what we flee from. And what I love about, you know, the tree, it made me think of this beautiful poem by Mark Nepo. I never know if it's Nepo or Nepo, because I see it, but I don't hear it. Nepo, that's what I thought. And he says, we waste so much energy trying to cover up who we are, when beneath every attitude is the want to be loved, and beneath every anger is a wound to be healed, and beneath every sadness is the fear that there will not be enough time. Our challenge each day is not to get dressed to face the world, but to unglove ourselves so that the doorknob feels cold and the car handle feels wet and the kiss goodbye feels like the lips of another being, soft and unrepeatable. Our challenge each day is not to get dressed to face the world, but to unglove ourselves. So in my experience with practice, practicing with contemplating death is one of the ways to help us learn to unglove, to touch the world and be touched more fully by it. And there are formal practices for exploring our relationship with death. You know, there's in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the first foundation of mindfulness that teaches about practices related to the body, there's the charnel ground or corpse meditations. We're not going to do that tonight. And that's not for everyone. It's a powerful practice. But I've become really curious over the years, how do we just bring this into daily life to normalize it? And so I want to share with you three of my favorite simple practices that you can do in a moment. And the first one is contemplating, this could be my last breath. This could be my last breath. And this is referenced in one of the suttas, the Maranasati Sutta, the contemplation of death Sutta, and I'll just paraphrase. This is not the words of the Buddha, but the essence of the Buddha was sitting with some of his monks, and you know, they were talking about how do you cultivate an awareness of death, and the monks were offering different answers, and you know, one of them said, well, I contemplate that I could be here for another day and another night. You know, and another monk is like, I contemplate I could be here for the duration to eat this next meal. And, you know, some different answers. And then a monk says, you know, I contemplate that I could be here for this breath, you know, this in-breath, this out-breath. And the Buddha said that to practice as if you had another day and another night was heedless. And he said, the way to practice, the wise way to practice is as if you have this next breath. This breath, this half breath right here, this inhale or this exhale. And so he was like, get real. This is it. I mean, he didn't say that, but that's, you know, modern day interpretation. It's like, oh, wow. You know, even a day, that's a luxury we actually don't know we have. And so it's been really, it's been juicy, I've found, over the years to play with, oh, this could be my last breath. And sometimes I work with that in a formal sitting period, taking just a little while. You know, and sometimes I just, somewhere in my day, something connects me with, oh, this appreciation. You know, I hear an ambulance drive by, or I see an accident, or, you know, I see a dead animal by the side of the road, and it, like, reminds me, oh, you know, I don't know. And this could be my last breath is a way of bringing me home to this moment right here. You know, like, this could be my last breath. And sometimes I add for myself, don't you want to be here for it? You know, it's like, oh, okay, if this is it, I should enjoy it. I should be here. You know, and even if it's not your last breath, this breath brings you one breath closer to whatever your last breath is going to be, whenever that is. So, you know, what if we could be with as many of those breaths between here and there? So that's the first practice that I really, you know, I really like. And we often think, oh, I have time. I have time. And one of the things I liked was at this retreat, we were invited to write haikus, little poems that have like 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables about death or about impermanence. And one of them, that I wrote, that I actually copied out and I just put on my bathroom mirror, helps me remember about this illusion of time. And I'll just offer a tiny bit of context so it makes sense. One of the things about meditating at Spirit Rock, especially in the spring, is at the creek there's frogs in great numbers, and they sing and they stop and they sing and they stop, and it's a great lesson in impermanence, and they come and go, and they're a great meditation object. So this little haiku showed up in my practice at one point, and it says, we think there is time. Frog chorus stops abruptly. This could be your last. You know, I ran out of syllables before I could even complete the sentence. This could be your last. And it's just really, you know, helpful. And you may, in your own life, sort of find ways of just playing with. This could be my last breath. The second practice that I really like are the 5 remembrances, which some of you may be familiar with. These are 5 contemplations. Of truths that are often overlooked, but really foundational to our experience of being human. There are many translations. My My personal favorite of the past few years is one from the Meta Institute, which is in Sausalito, California. And the five remembrances are this. This body is of the nature to age. There is no way to escape aging. This body is of the nature to have ill health. There's no way to escape having ill health. This body is of the nature to die. There's no way to escape death. Everyone and everything I love is of the nature to change, and there's no way to escape being separated from them. And my actions are my only true belongings. There's no way to escape the consequences of my actions. They are the ground upon which I stand. And one of the things that, you know, I love about these contemplations are that, you know, they just help me remember to be here. And I also like their honesty that really the only thing I can own is, you know, is my karma, you know, in the Buddhist, in the classic framing of this, usually karma is the languaging of the fifth remembrance, but I sort of like the lay language. But all I can own is the cause and effect, the impact of my actions. I can't own my body. It's gonna decay and eventually die. I can't own my belongings. I can't own my loved ones. It's all gonna fall away. But, you know, planting these seeds of, you know, wholesome, good actions, that carries me from moment to moment to moment. And then afterwards, who knows where that carries us, but it at least is goodness through this lifetime. And that feels really honest, because sometimes we get so tangled up with this life, you know, with everything we're trying to achieve and acquire and hold on to. And for me, it helps soften that stickiness. You know, it's not quite as compelling to grab hold of all this stuff. And this, too, can be a formal practice. Sometimes I drop this into a sitting practice. But sometimes it's an informal practice. Again, something in daily life prompts me to think about one of these truths. You know, that, oh, I might hear a siren. I might see somebody who's really old, who's like driving super slow in front of me, and I get impatient, and then I remember, oh, you know, just like that old person, this body right here is of the nature to age, and if I'm fortunate enough, that might be me someday, you know? So it's like really brings in a sense of connection and non-separation and also a sense of honesty. So, and if folks are not familiar with the five remembrances, I did bring some copies, so you're welcome to pick one of those up afterwards, because sometimes they really speak to folks, so you can take that home with you. The other practice that I really love is noticing endings. Sometimes when we practice with impermanence, you know, we're invited to notice beginnings and endings, the arising and passing of things. And when we work with impermanence related to death or death contemplation, sometimes it's really potent to hone in on endings. And they're everywhere too. And there's this lovely little piece by Sousa Talon. She's an artist. She says, E is for endings, for the wise reminder that endings don't just happen at the big end of a movie or a day or a life. They happen all day long. Breakfast ends, coffee too, a conversation, a feeling, a moment of praise or blame. It all comes to an end. If we can meet and know the moment-to-moment endings each day, then maybe the big ones won't feel so big. So there's this wisdom in noticing endings, you know, and it's a form of practice for sort of the big end, or the big I, the big impermanence of death. And so her little writing, you know, points to practice as good preparation. One of the days at our retreat, we had a guest teaching from Bhikkhu Anayo, and he has written a book on Maranasati, or on death practice, and I really appreciated a number of his statements and encouragements on death practice. He said, you know, you don't start studying for the big, you know, exam on the day of the test. You don't start training for the competition on the day of the marathon. You know, you don't start practicing to die on the day that you're dying. Now, some of us, if we're honest, may start studying for the test on the day of the test, or, you know, training late. But ideally, it's actually really helpful to condition ourselves and to prepare, and to prepare daily for, he talks about the art of dying. And then on the flip side of that, as we're preparing for the art of dying, we're actually learning about the art of living. And I want to say a few words about supports for practicing in this way, because practicing with death can open us to really tender places. You know, it can be connected to previous losses, to fears about the future. It can be related to our own vulnerability, or the vulnerability of those that we love, our parents, our friends, our children, our community. And so it's really good to have companions for this journey. And some of the best companions are the heart practices. And John gave such a lovely introduction to mudita, which is one of those heart practices. So we have the four heavenly messengers: aging, illness, dying, and awakening. And we have the four heavenly abodes: kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And they really support each other, these practices. You know, they help us open the heart. They support us in bringing tenderness to vulnerability. They help us not miss the joyful that is present. The joyful is all around us, just like death is all around us. And they help us find a quality of balance amidst the storms that life is swirling our way. And on this retreat, I revisited this combination. Metta, or loving kindness practice, has been a long time practice for me as well. And to spend a week very intensively practicing both, you know, I really came to feel how kindness is a powerful practice for learning how to live, how to bring a quality of friendliness, warmth, support, gentleness to ourselves, to other people, to life, and how it's also a really welcome and robust quality for preparing for vulnerability, for aging, for illness, for dying. And you know, I was thinking that who knows, because most of, you know, we don't get a dress rehearsal, who knows what we get to choose at that moment of death, or if we get to choose. But one of the things I do know and believe from my practice and from neuroscience as a psychologist is that what we practice is more available to us when we cultivate pathways in the mind and heart. They are more available, they're more accessible. So these Brahma Viharas, these heavenly abodes, kindness seems like a really great quality to potentially have accessible at the time of death. Whether it's our own transition or somebody else that we care about. And so, it can be a way of softening sitting with what can be scary and uncertain. And it can travel with us sort of this whole journey of life. And one of the things that I found, because the two practices that I was playing with the most was this could be my last breath and metta. And it was interesting how they started to show up in intertwined with each other. I'd be doing a period of this could be your last breath, and all of a sudden I'd have this sense of metta arise. Or I was doing metta and, you know, all of a sudden I had this sense of, oh, this could be my last breath. Or this could be your last breath. And this sense of interconnection and the preciousness of time and the poignancy of connection became more and more apparent. It reminded me of, there's these two little lines in the Dhammapada, and I couldn't find my other copy, but it's in the... It's in the piece where it follows from this paragraph. In this world, hate never yet dispelled hate. Only love dispels hate. This is the law, ancient and inexhaustible. And the last two lines are, you too shall pass away. Knowing this, how can you quarrel? You too shall pass away. Knowing this, how can you quarrel? And as I was practicing, you know, metta, and this could be your last breath, it sort of popped up for me working with the difficult person, the person I was having difficulty with, and it actually softened that sense of angst I was feeling about this difficult connection. Like, oh, you know, this is really precious. And what if my heart could just soften around this tension? So practicing in this way has a number of benefits. Some of them I've already been naming, but to really look at them more in detail, you know, it opens us, it can open our heart more fully to life. It can really help us clear away the clutter and reorient to what's important. How do I want to spend this one wild, precious life, sort of to borrow from that line from a Mary Oliver poem. And it, just to put it in context, in contrast, this quote by Sam Harris, he did a talk on death and the present moment. This is what most of us do most of the time when we're not practicing with death. He says, most of us do our best to not think about death. But there's always a part of our minds that knows this can't go on forever. Part of us always knows that we're just a doctor's visit away, a phone call away, from being starkly reminded with the fact of our own mortality or of those closest to us. I'm sure many of you in this room have experienced this in some form. You must know how uncanny it is to suddenly be thrown out of the normal course of your life and just be given a full-time job of not dying or caring for someone who is. The one thing people tend to realize at moments like this is that they wasted a lot of time when life was normal. It's not just what they did with their time, it's not just what they spent too much time that they spent too much time working or compulsively checking email. It's that they cared about the wrong things. They regret what they cared about. Their attention was bound up in petty concerns year after year when life was normal. And this is a paradox, of course, because we all know this epiphany is coming. Don't you know this is coming? Don't you know that there's gonna come a day when you'll be sick or someone close to you will die and you'll look back on the kinds of things that captured your attention and you'll think, what was I doing? You know this, and yet, if you're like most people, you'll spend most of your time in life tacitly presuming you'll live forever, doing things like watching a bad movie for the fourth time or bickering with your spouse. These things only make sense in light of eternity. These things only make sense in light of eternity. So, you know, Sam Harris is pointing to, like, this is the hamster wheel most of us are on. This is automatic pilot. And when we open to practicing with death, to acknowledging it's there, it's in the room with us, we start to save ourselves from these regrets, from these missed moments, from these misaligned priorities or values. We have the opportunity to really be present, to connect. You know, we get real, like, oh my gosh, it's like this, it's like this. And as the Buddha said, we can then ardently do today what must be done. Tomorrow, death comes. Ardently, do today what must be done. Tomorrow, death comes. So we're not waiting. And we start to experience this peace of clear seeing. There's actually some real peace in being like, oh, it's like this. I'm not immortal. It's like this. It's precious. It's so precious. And we see that we're here for a very short time, you know. And for some, it's a very short time. It's a matter of years. And others, it's decades. And what I'm learning, I have a grandfather who next, oh my gosh, this weekend turns 99. You know, he's been here almost a century. And I really have learned from him, like, that's not that long. It's not enough. You know, he was in the hospital and he wanted a full resuscitation. The doctors are like, really? And, you know, he's doing really well. He still lives independently. And, you know, and they're like, really? And he's like, well, I'm not looking forward to what you have to do to get me back here, but I'm not ready to go, you know? And it's not that he's like afraid of death or, I mean, he loves his family and he loves life. So even 100 years, it's not that long. Not that long. The Diamond Sutra has this really lovely passage that says, that speaks to this. Like, what's the truth of this life? Thus shall ye think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. Like, that's what this life is. It's really ephemeral. So living with this perspective of preciousness, so we see the truth of impermanence, but we also start to see the truth of interconnectedness more fully. You know, the mystery and you were talking about generosity, and one of the things that I find, the more I work with the messengers, especially contemplation of death, is a blossoming of the heart in gratitude. Gratitude for this life, and also for how much is gifted, how much is given, how interdependent we are. And I was thinking about this on reflecting on an example, and one of them that's the richest for me, and it really amazed me on this retreat. I love gratitude practice before meals. I always have. It's one of the no matter how crazy my life is, I try to pause before meals and offer gratitude. And retreat just sort of popped that open even more this time. And And I wanted to share with you, like, where gratitude took me with this meal. So I had a bowl of soup and a salad. And this is also informed by, I volunteer, I have for many years, on a CSA. So working on a farm and seeing, like, what it really takes to bring good, wholesome, organic food to the table has been so heart-opening for me. So I'm sitting with this, you know, this bowl of soup and this salad, and here's grace. It's something like, oh, you know, gratitude to the sun and the soil and the seeds and all the people who have kept seeds alive and heirloom seeds and water and all the water sources, the rain, maybe ditch water, ag water, city water, and all of the infrastructure that brought the water to this farm and all the people who work in those systems. And thank you to the machinery and the tools and the people who made them and who serviced them and sharpened them, and to the earth for the metals that created them in the first place. And thank you to the farmers and the farmhands and the field hands, and to the pollinators and to the worms and to the nematodes and to all of the nitrogen-fixing plants and to the, you know, the people who created the recipes and those who made the cookbooks and printed the cookbooks and that whole infrastructure. And thank you to all the yogis who spent time chopping and washing and prepping, and the cooks and those who did the laundry and for the towels that washed the dishes and all those who washed the dishes. And thank you for the dishes and the whole pipe stream that brought those and the chairs and the tables and the dining hall and all of the people who built it and all the generosity and the donations. And that's actually the truth of what it is to eat a meal and that interconnectedness. And we often miss that, you know, because we're just in this automatic pilot place. And this may or may not end up being your experience, but for me, the more I have touched into practice with death and loss and the letting go, the more I see the mystery and the magic and the interconnectedness and the generosity that and the truth that we don't do this life alone at all, ever, in any way, which is so powerful. It's like that's reality. One of the teachers on this retreat was Eugene Cash, and one of his favorite phrases is like, reality is wild. You know, it's like reality is like bigger and more complex and more interconnected than we can imagine. So this practice, you know, when we open to it, in many ways, I find the only response that makes sense in this life is like, wow, and thank you. So, you know, on that note, my hope is that there's some inspiration for what's the value of hanging out with this friend death, and could it actually be a friend to you in your practice? And maybe one of these simple ways of, oh, this could be my last breath, or the five remembrances, or noticing endings may open you more fully to some of this sense of connection and fullness and appreciation for life. I'm not super familiar with the Zen tradition, but I have a dear friend who sits in this tradition, and one of the things that he's shared is on the Zen Han, which is the big wooden block that they strike to call you to sit. There's a quote, there's many translations of this as well. This is one. Great is the matter of birth and death. Life passes swiftly and is easily lost. Awaken, awaken. Do not waste your life. Awaken, awaken. Do not waste your life. Let's just sit for a minute. Let this settle into our being. And whenever we sit, we never sit for just ourselves alone. This precious life, this precious practice is held for the benefit of all beings. So may any of the goodness arising from our gathering together to share the Dharma, may it be offered for the well-being of all beings. May all beings know the preciousness of this life. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings awaken, awaken. Thank you for your kind attention.